and was regarded as a pleasant event and a chance for fun. No living hobbit, save Bilbo, could remember the fell winter of 1311, when the white wolves invaded the Shire over the frozen Brandywine. Gandalf faltered. Snow was thick on his hood and shoulders. It was already ankle-deep about his boots.
"That is what I feared," he said. "What do you say now, Aragorn?"
"But I feared it too," Aragorn answered. "But less than other things. I knew the risk of snow, though it seldom falls heavily so far south, save high up in the mountains. But we are not high yet. We're still far down, where the paths are usually open all the winter."
"I wonder if this is a contrivance of the enemy," said Boromir. "They say in my land that he can govern the storms in the mountains of shadow that stand upon the borders of Mordor. He has strange powers and many allies."
"His arm has grown long indeed," said Gimli. "If he can draw snow down from the north to trouble us here 300 leagues away."
"His arm has grown long," said Gandalf.
While they were halted, the wind died down, and the snow slackened until it almost ceased. They tramped on again. But they had not gone more than a furlong when the storm returned with fresh fury. The wind whistled and the snow became a blinding blizzard. Soon even Boromir found it hard to keep going. The hobbits, bent nearly double, toiled along behind the taller folk, but it was plain that they could not go much further if the snow continued. Frodo's feet felt like lead. Pippin was dragging behind. Even Gimli, as stout as any dwarf could be, was grumbling as he trudged. The company halted suddenly, as if they had come to an agreement without any words being spoken. They heard eerie noises in the darkness round them. It may have been only a trick of the wind in the cracks and gullies of the rocky wall, but the sounds were those of shrill cries and wild howls of laughter. Stones began to fall from the mountainside, whistling over their heads or crashing on the path beside them. Every now and again they heard a dull rumble, as a great boulder rolled down from hidden heights above.
"We cannot go further tonight," said Boromir. "Let those call it the wind who will. There are fell voices on the air, and these stones are aimed at us."
"I do call it the wind," said Aragorn, "but that doesn't make what you say untrue. There are many evil and unfriendly things in the world that have little love for those that go on two legs, and yet are not in league with Sauron, but have purposes of their own. Some have been in this world longer than he."
"Carathras was called the Cruel, and had an ill name," said Gimli. "Long years ago, when rumour of Sauron had not been heard in these lands. It matters little who is the enemy, if we cannot beat off his attack," said Gandalf.
"But what can we do?"
cried Pippin miserably. He was leaning on Merry and Frodo, and he was shivering.
"Either stop where we are, or go back," said Gandalf. "It's no good going on. Only a little higher, if I remember rightly, this path leaves the cliff and runs into a wide, shallow trough at the bottom of a long, hard slope. We should have no shelter there from snow or stones or anything else."
"And it's no good going back while the storm holds," said Aragorn. "We've passed no place on the way up that offered more shelter than this cliff wall we're under now."
"Shelter?" muttered Sam. "If this is shelter, then one wall and no roof make a house."
The company now gathered together as close to the cliff as they could. It faced southwards, and near the bottom it leaned out a little, so that they hoped it would give them some protection from the northerly wind and from the falling stones. But eddying blasts swirled around them from every side, and the snow flowed down in even denser clouds. They huddled together with their backs to the wall. Bill the pony stood patiently but dejectedly in front of the hobbits, and screened them a little. But before long the drifting snow was above his hocks, and it went on mounting. If they had had no larger companions, the hobbits would soon have been entirely buried. A great sleepiness came over Frodo. He felt himself sinking fast into a warm and hazy dream. He thought a fire was heating his toes, and out of the shadows on the other side of the hearth he heard Bilbo's voice speaking.
"I don't think much of your diary," he said. "Snowstorms on January the 12th? There was no need to come back to report that."
"But I wanted rest and sleep, Bilbo," Frodo answered with an effort, when he felt himself shaken, and he came back painfully to wakefulness. Boromir had lifted him off the ground, out of a nest of snow.
"This will be the death of the halflings, Gandalf," said Boromir. "It's useless to sit here until the snow goes over our heads. We must do something to save ourselves."
"Give them this," said Gandalf, searching in his pack and drawing out a leathern flask. "Just a mouthful each, for all of us. It's very precious. It is Mirovor, the cordial of Imladris. Elrond gave it to me at our parting. Pass it round." As soon as Frodo had swallowed a little of the warm and fragrant liquor, he felt a new strength of heart, and the heavy drowsiness left his limbs. The others also revived and found fresh hope and vigour. But the snow did not relent. It whirled about them thicker than ever, and the wind blew louder.
"What do you say to fire?" asked Boromir suddenly. "The choice seems near now between fire and death, Gandalf. Doubtless we shall be hidden from all unfriendly eyes when the snow has covered us, but that will not help us."
"You may make a fire if you can," answered Gandalf. "If there are any watchers that can endure this storm, then they can see us, fire or no."
But though they had brought wood and kindlings by the advice of Boromir, it passed the skill of elf or even dwarf to strike a flame that would hold amid the swirling wind or catch in the wet fuel. At last, reluctantly, Gandalf himself took a hand. Picking up a faggot, he held it aloft for a moment, and then, with a word of command, "Nauaran edraith amen," he thrust the end of his staff into the midst of it. At once a great spout of green and blue flame sprang out, and the wood flared and sputtered.
"If there are any to see, then I at least am revealed to them," he said. "I have written, Gandalf is here, in signs that all can read from Rivendell to the mouths of Anduin."
But the company cared no longer for watchers or unfriendly eyes. Their hearts were rejoiced to see the light of the fire. The wood burned merrily, and though all round it the snow hissed, and pools of slush crept under their feet, they warmed their hands gladly at the blaze. There they stood, stooping in a circle round the little dancing and blowing flames. A red light was on their tired and anxious faces. Behind them the night was like a black wall. But the wood was burning fast, and the snow still fell. The fire burned low, and the last faggot was thrown on.
"The night is getting old," said Aragorn. "The dawn is not far off."
"If any dawn can pierce these clouds," said Gimli.
Boromir stepped out of the circle and stared up into the blackness.
"The snow is growing less," he said, "and the wind is quieter."
Frodo gazed wearily at the flakes still falling out of the dark to be revealed white for a moment in the light of the dying fire. But for a long time he could see no sign of their slackening. Then suddenly, as sleep was beginning to creep over him again, he was aware that the wind had indeed fallen, and the flakes were becoming larger and fewer. Very slowly a dim light began to grow. At last the snow stopped altogether. As the light grew stronger, it showed a silent, shrouded world. Below their refuge were white humps and domes and shapeless deeps, beneath which the path that they had trodden was altogether lost. But the heights above were hidden in great clouds, still heavy with the threat of snow. Gimli looked up and shook his head.
"Carathras has not forgiven us," he said. "He has more snow yet to fling at us if we go on. The sooner we go back and down, the better."
To this all agreed, but their retreat was now difficult. It might well prove impossible. Only a few paces from the ashes of their fire, the snow lay many feet deep, higher than the heads of the hobbits. In places it had been scooped and piled by the wind to great drifts against the cliff.
"If Gandalf could go before us with a bright flame, he might melt a path for you," said Legolas. The storm had troubled him little, and he alone of the company remained still light of heart.
"If elves could fly over mountains, they might fetch the sun to save us," answered Gandalf. "But I must have something to work on. I cannot burn snow."
"Well," said Boromir, "when heads are at a loss, bodies must serve, as we say in my country. The strongest of us must seek a way. See, though all is now snow-clad, our path, as we came up, turned about that shoulder of rock down yonder. It was there that the snow first began to burden us. If we could reach that point, maybe it would prove easier beyond. It is no more than a furlong off, I guess."
"Then let us force a path thither, you and I," said Aragorn.
Aragorn was the tallest of the company, but Boromir, little less in height, was broader and heavier in build. He led the way, and Aragorn followed him. Slowly they moved off, and were soon toiling heavily. In places the snow was breast high, and often Boromir seemed to be swimming or burrowing with his great arms rather than walking. Legolas watched them for a while with a smile upon his lips, and then he turned to the others. "The strongest must seek a way, say you, but I say, let a ploughman plough, but choose an otter for swimming, and for running light over grass and leaf or over snow, an elf." With that he sprang forth nimbly, and then Frodo noticed, as if for the first time, though he had long known it, that the elf had no boots, but wore only light shoes, as he always did, and his feet made little imprint in the snow. "Farewell," he said to Gandalf, "I go to find the sun." Then, swift as a runner over firm sand, he shot away, and quickly overtaking the toiling men, with a wave of his hand he passed them, and sped into the distance, and vanished round the rocky turn. The others waited huddled together, watching until Boromir and Aragorn dwindled into black specks in the whiteness. At length they, too, passed from sight. The time dragged on, the clouds lowered, and now a few flakes of snow came curling down again. An hour, maybe, went by, though it seemed far longer, and then at last they saw Legolas coming back. At the same time Boromir and Aragorn reappeared round the bend far behind him, and came labouring up the slope. "Well," cried Legolas as he ran up, "I've not brought the sun. She's walking in the blue fields of the south, and a little wreath of snow on this Redhorn hillock troubles her not at all. But I've brought back a gleam of good hope for those who are doomed to go on feet. There is the greatest wind drift of all just beyond the turn, and there our strong men are almost buried. They despaired until I returned and told them that the drift was little wider than a wall, and on the other side the snow suddenly grows less, while further down it is no more than a white coverlet to cool a hobbit's toes."
"Ah, it's as I said," growled Gimli. "It was no ordinary storm. It's the ill will of Carathras. He does not love elves and dwarves, and that drift was laid to cut off our escape."
"But happily your Carathras has forgotten that you have men with you," said Boromir, who came up at that moment, "and doughty men too, if I may say it, though lesser men with spades might have served you better. Still, we've thrust a lane through the drift, and for that all here may be grateful who cannot run as light as elves."
"But how are we to get down there, even if you have cut through the drift?" said Pippin, voicing the thought of all the hobbits.
"Have hope," said Boromir. "I am weary, but I still have some strength left, and Aragorn too. We will bear the little folk. The others, no doubt, will make shift to tread the path behind us. Come, Master Peregrine, I'll begin with you." He lifted up the hobbit. "Cling to my back. I shall need my arms," he said, and strode forward. Aragorn with Merry came behind.
Pippin marvelled at his strength, seeing the passage that he had already forced with no other tool than his great limbs. Even now, burdened as he was widening the track of those who followed, thrusting the snow aside as he went. They came at length to the great drift. It was flung across the mountain path like a sheer and sudden wall, and its crest, sharp as if shaped with knives, reared up more than twice the height of Boromir.
but through the middle a passage had been beaten, rising and falling like a bridge. On the far side Merry and Pippin were set down, and there they waited with Legolas for the rest of the company to arrive. After a while Boromir returned, carrying Sam. Behind in the narrow but now well-trodden track came Gandalf, leading Bill with Gimli perched among the baggage. Last came Aragorn, carrying Frodo. They passed through the lane, but hardly had Frodo touched the ground when with a deep rumble there rolled down a fall of stones and slithering snow. The spray of it half blinded the company as they crouched against the cliff, and when the air cleared again they saw that the path was blocked behind them.
"Enough, enough," cried Gimli. "We're departing as quickly as we may."
And indeed, with that last stroke, the malice of the mountain seemed to be expended, as if Carathras was satisfied that the invaders had been beaten off and would not dare to return. The threat of snow lifted, the clouds began to break, and the light grew broader. As Legolas had reported, they found that the snow became steadily more shallow as they went down, so that even the hobbits could trudge along. Soon they all stood once more on the flat shelf at the head of the steep slope, where they had felt the first flakes of snow the night before. The morning was now far advanced. From the high place they looked back westwards over the lower lands. Far away in the tumble of country that lay at the foot of the mountain was the dell from which they had started to climb the pass. Frodo's legs ached. He was chilled to the bone and hungry, and his head was dizzy as he thought of the long and painful march downhill. Black specks swam before his eyes. He rubbed them, but the black specks remained. In the distance below him, but still high above the lower foothills, dark dots were circling in the air.
"The birds again," said Aragorn, pointing down. "That cannot be helped now," said Gandalf. "Whether they are good or evil, or have nothing to do with us at all, we must go down at once. Not even on the knees of Carathras will we wait for another nightfall." A cold wind flowed down behind them, as they turned their backs on the Redhorn Gate and stumbled wearily down the slope. Carathras had defeated them.
Chapter 4. A Journey in the Dark. It was evening, and the grey light was again waning fast, when they halted for the night. They were very weary. The mountains were veiled in deepening dusk, and the wind was cold. Gandalf spared them one more mouthful each of the Mirovor of Rivendell. When they had eaten some food, he called a council.
"We cannot, of course, go on again tonight," he said. "The attack on the Redhorn Gate has tired us out, and we must rest here for a while."
"And then where are we to go?" asked Frodo.
"We still have our journey and our errand before us," answered Gandalf. "We have no choice but to go on, or to return to Rivendell."
Pippin's face brightened visibly at the mere mention of return to Rivendell. Merry and Sam looked away hopefully, but Aragorn and Boromir made no sign. Frodo looked troubled. "I wish I was back there," he said. "But how can I return without shame, unless there is indeed no other way, and we are already defeated?"
"You are right, Frodo," said Gandalf. "To go back is to admit defeat, and face worse defeat to come. If we go back now, then the ring must remain there. We shall not be able to set out again. Then sooner or later Rivendell will be besieged, and after a brief and bitter time it will be destroyed. The Ringwraiths are deadly enemies, but they are only shadows yet of the power and terror they would possess if the ruling ring was on their master's hand again."
"Then we must go on, if there's a way," said Frodo with a sigh. Sam sank back into gloom.
"There is a way that we may attempt," said Gandalf. "I thought from the beginning, when I first considered this journey, that we should try it. But it is not a pleasant way, and I have not spoken of it to the company before. Aragorn was against it until the pass over the mountains had at least been tried."
"If it's a worse road than the Redhorn Gate, then it must be evil indeed," said Merry. "But you'd better tell us all about it, and let us know the worst at once."
"The road that I speak of leads to the mines of Moria," said Gandalf. Only Gimli lifted up his head. A smouldering fire was in his eyes. On all the others a dread fell at the mention of that name. Even to the hobbits it was a legend of vague fear. "The road may lead to Moria, but how can we hope that it will lead through Moria?" said Aragorn darkly. "It is a name of ill omen," said Boromir. "Nor do I see the need to go there. If we cannot cross the mountains, let us journey southwards until we come to the Gap of Rohan, where men are friendly to my people, taking the road that I followed on my way hither. Or we might pass by and cross the ice and into Langstrand and Lebenin, and so come to Gondor from the regions nigh to the sea." "Things have changed since you came north, Boromir," answered Gandalf. "Did you not hear what I told you of Saruman? With him I may have business of my own ere all is over. But the ring must not come near Isengard, if that can be by any means prevented. The Gap of Rohan is closed to us while we go with the bearer. As for the longer road, we cannot afford the time. We might spend a year in such a journey, and we should pass through many lands that are empty and harbourless. Yet they would not be safe. The watchful eyes of both Saruman and of the enemy are on them. When you came north, Boromir, you were in the enemy's eyes only one stray wanderer from the south, and a matter of small concern to him. His mind was busy with the pursuit of the ring. But you return now as a member of the ring's company, and you are in peril as long as you remain with us. The danger will increase with every league that we go south under the naked sky. Since our open attempt on the mountain pass, our plight has become more desperate, I fear. I see now little hope, if we do not soon vanish from sight for a while and cover our trail. Therefore I advise that we should go neither over the mountains nor round them, but under them. There is a road at any rate that the enemy will least expect us to take." "We do not know what he expects," said Boromir. "He may watch all roads, likely and unlikely. In that case to enter Moria would be to walk into a trap, hardly better than knocking at the gates of the Dark Tower itself. The name of Moria is black." "You speak of what you do not know when you liken Moria to the stronghold of Sauron," answered Gandalf. "I alone of you have ever been in the dungeons of the Dark Lord, and only in his older and lesser dwelling in Dol Guldur. Those who pass the gates of Barad-dûr do not return. But I would not lead you into Moria if there were no hope of coming out again. If there are orcs there, it may prove ill for us, that is true. But most of the orcs of the Misty Mountains were scattered or destroyed in the Battle of Five Armies. The eagles report that orcs are gathering again from afar, but there is a hope that Moria is still free." "There is even a chance that dwarves are there, and that in some deep hall of his father's, Balin, son of Fundin, may be found. However it may prove, one must tread the path that need chooses."
"I will tread the path with you, Gandalf," said Gimli. "I will go and look on the halls of Durin, whatever may wait there, if you can find the doors that are shut."
"Good, Gimli," said Gandalf. "You encourage me. We will seek the hidden doors together, and we will come through. In the ruins of the dwarves, a dwarf's head will be less easy to bewilder than elves or men or hobbits. Yet it will not be the first time that I have been to Moria. I sought there long for Thrain, son of Thror, after he was lost. I passed through, and I came out again alive."
"I too once passed the Dimrul Gate," said Aragorn quietly. "But though I also came out again, the memory is very evil. I don't wish to enter Moria a second time."
"And I don't wish to enter it even once," said Pippin.
"Nor me," muttered Sam.
"Of course not," said Gandalf. "Who would? But the question is, who will follow me if I lead you there?"
"I will,"
said Gimli eagerly.
"I will," said Aragorn heavily. "You followed my lead almost to disaster in the snow, and have said no word of blame."
"I will follow your lead now,
if this last warning does not move you. It's not of the ring, nor of us others that I'm thinking now, but of you, Gandalf. And I say to you, if you pass the doors of Moria, beware.
I will not go, said Boromir, not unless the vote of the whole company is against me. What do Legolas and the little folk say? The ring-bearer's voice surely should be heard.
I do not wish to go to Moria, said Legolas. The hobbit said nothing. Sam looked at Frodo. At last Frodo spoke. I do not wish to go, he said, but neither do I wish to refuse the advice of Gandalf. I beg that there should be no vote until we've slept on it. Gandalf will get votes easier in the light of the morning than in this cold gloom. How the wind howls! At these words all fell into silent thought. They heard the wind hissing among the rocks and trees, and there was a howling and wailing round them in the empty spaces of the night. Suddenly Aragorn leaped to his feet.
"How the wind howls!" he cried. "It is howling with wolf voices. The wargs have come west of the mountains."
"Need we wait until morning, then?" said Gandalf. "It's as I said, the hunt is up. Even if we live to see the dawn, who now will wish to journey south by night with the wild wolves on his trail?"
"How far is Moria?" asked Boromir.
"There was a door southwest of Carathras, some 15 miles as the crow flies, and maybe 20 as the wolf runs," answered Gandalf grimly.
"Then let us start as soon as it's light tomorrow, if we can," said Boromir. "The wolf that one hears is worse than the orc that one fears."
"True," said Aragorn, loosening his sword in its sheath.
"But where the warg howls, there also the orc prowls."
"I wish I'd taken Elrond's advice," muttered Pippin to Sam. "I'm no good after all. There's not enough of the breed of Bandobras the bull-roarer in me. These howls freeze my blood. I don't ever remember feeling so wretched."
"My heart's right down in my toes, Mr. Pippin," said Sam. "But we aren't ettin' yet, and there are some stout folk here with us. Whatever may be in store for old Gandalf, I'll wager it isn't a wolf's belly." For their defence in the night, the company climbed to the top of the small hill under which they had been sheltering. It was crowned with a knot of old and twisted trees, about which lay a broken circle of boulder stones. In the midst of this they lit a fire, for there was no hope that darkness and silence would keep their trail from discovery by the hunting packs. Round the fire they sat, and those that were not on guard dozed uneasily. Poor Bill the pony trembled and sweated where he stood. The howling of the wolves was now all round them, sometimes nearer and sometimes further off. In the dead of the night many shining eyes were seen peering over the brow of the hill. Some advanced almost to the ring of stones. At a gap in the circle, a great dark wolf shape could be seen halted, gazing at them. A shuddering howl broke from him, as if he were a captain summoning his pack to the assault. Gandalf stood up and strode forward, holding his staff aloft.
"Listen, hound of Sauron," he cried. "Gandalf is here. Fly if you value your foul skin. I will shrivel you from tail to snout if you come within this ring."
The wolf snarled and sprang towards them with a great leap. At that moment there was a sharp twang. Legolas had loosed his bow. There was a hideous yell, and the leaping shape thudded to the ground. The elvish arrow had pierced its throat. The watching eyes were suddenly extinguished. Gandalf and Aragorn strode forward, but the hill was deserted. The hunting packs had fled. All about them the darkness grew silent, and no cry came on the sighing wind. The night was old, and westward the waning moon was setting, gleaming fitfully through the breaking clouds. Suddenly Frodo started from sleep. Without warning, a storm of howls broke out fierce and wild all about the camp. A great host of wargs had gathered silently and was now attacking them from every side at once.
"Fling fuel on the fire!" cried Gandalf to the hobbits. Draw your blades, and stand back to back.
In the leaping light, as the fresh wood blazed up, Frodo saw many grey shapes spring over the ring of stones. More and more followed. Through the throat of one huge leader, Aragorn passed his sword with a thrust. With a great sweep, Boromir hewed the head off another. Beside them, Gimli stood with his stout legs apart, wielding his dwarf axe. In the wavering firelight, Gandalf seemed suddenly to grow. He rose up, a great menacing shape like the monument of some ancient king of stone set upon a hill. Stooping like a cloud, he lifted a burning branch and strode to meet the wolves. They gave back before him. High in the air he tossed the blazing brand. It flared with a sudden white radiance like lightning, and his voice rolled like thunder.
"Nar Arnedraith Armin! Nar Dungaurhoth!" he cried.
There was a roar and a crackle, and the tree above him burst into a leaf and bloom of blinding flame. The fire leapt from treetop to treetop. The whole hill was crowned with dazzling light. The swords and knives of the defenders shone and flickered. The last arrow of Legolas kindled in the air as it flew, and plunged, burning into the heart of a great wolf chieftain. All the others fled. Slowly the fire died, till nothing was left but falling ash and sparks. A bitter smoke curled above the burned tree stumps, and blew darkly from the hill, as the first light of dawn came dimly in the sky. Their enemies were routed and did not return.
"What did I tell you, Mr. Pippin?" said Sam, sheathing his sword. "Wolves won't get him."
"That was an eye-opener and no mistake. Nearly singed the hair off my head."
When the full light of the morning came, no signs of the wolves were to be found, and they looked in vain for the bodies of the dead. No trace of the fight remained but the charred trees and the arrows of Legolas lying on the hilltop. All were undamaged, save one of which only the point was left.
"It is as I feared," said Gandalf. "They were no ordinary wolves hunting for food in the wilderness. Let us eat quickly and go."
That day the weather changed again, almost as if it was at the command of some power that had no longer any use for snow, since they had retreated from the pass, a power that wished now to have a clear light in which things that moved in the wild could be seen from far away. The wind had been turning through north to northwest during the night, and now it failed. The clouds vanished southwards, and the sky was opened high and blue. As they stood upon the hillside, ready to depart, a pale sunlight gleamed over the mountaintops.
"We must reach the doors before sunset," said Gandalf, "or I fear we shall not reach them at all. It's not far, but our path may be winding, for here Aragorn cannot guide us. He has seldom walked in this country, and only once have I been under the west wall of Moria, and that was long ago." "There it lies," he said, pointing away south-eastwards to where the mountain's sides fell sheer into the shadows at their feet. In the distance could be dimly seen a line of bare cliffs, and in their midst, taller than the rest, one great grey wall. "When we left the pass I led you southwards, and not back to our starting point, as some of you may have noticed. It's well that I did so, for now we have several miles less to cross, and haste is needed. Let us go." "I do not know which to hope," said Boromir grimly, "that Gandalf will find what he seeks, or that coming to the cliff we shall find the gates lost for ever. All choices seem ill, and to be caught between wolves and the wall the likeliest chance. Lead on."
Gimli now walked ahead by the wizard's side, so eager was he to come to Moria. Together they led the company back towards the mountains. The only road of old to Moria from the west had lain along the course of a stream, the Sirannon, that ran out from the feet of the cliffs near where the doors had stood. But either Gandalf was astray, or else the land had changed in recent years, for he did not strike the stream where he looked to find it, only a few miles southwards from their start. The morning was passing towards noon,
and still the company wandered and scrambled in a barren country of red stones. Nowhere could they see any gleam of water or hear any sound of it. All was bleak and dry. Their heart sank. They saw no living thing, and not a bird was in the sky. But what the night would bring, if it caught them in that lost land, none of them cared to think. Suddenly Gimli, who had pressed on ahead, called back to them. He was standing on a knoll and pointing to the right. Hurrying up, they saw below them a deep and narrow channel. It was empty and silent, and hardly a trickle of water flowed among the brown and red-stained stones of its bed. But on the near side there was a path, much broken and decayed, that wound its way among the ruined walls and paving-stones of an ancient high-road.
"Ah, here it is at last," said Gandalf. "This is where the stream ran. Sirannon, the gate-stream, they used to call it. But what has happened to the water, I cannot guess. It used to be swift and noisy. Come, we must hurry on. We are late."
The company were footsore and tired, but they trudged doggedly along the rough and winding track for many miles. The sun turned from the noon and began to go west. After a brief halt and a hasty meal, they went on again. Before them the mountains frowned, but their path lay in a deep trough of land, and they could see only the higher shoulders and the far eastward peaks. At length they came to a sharp bend. There the road, which had been veering southwards between the brink of the channel and a steep fall of the land to the left, turned and went due east again. Rounding the corner they saw before them a low cliff, some 5 fathoms high, with a broken and jagged top. Over it a trickling water dripped, through a wide cleft that seemed to have been carved out by a fall that had once been strong and full.
"Indeed things have changed," said Gandalf, "but there's no mistaking the place. There is all the remains of the stair falls. If I remember right, there was a flight of steps cut in the rock at their side, but the main road wound away left and climbed with several loops up to the level ground at the top. There used to be a shallow valley beyond the falls right up to the walls of Moria, and the Sirannon flowed through it with the road beside it. Let us go and see what things are like now."
They found the stone steps without difficulty, and Gimli sprang swiftly up them, followed by Gandalf and Frodo. When they reached the top, they saw that they could go no further that way, and the reason for the drying up of the gate stream was revealed. Behind them the sinking sun filled the cool western sky with glimmering gold. Before them stretched a dark, still lake. Neither sky nor sunset was reflected on its sullen surface. The Sirannon had been dammed and had filled all the valley. Beyond the ominous water were reared vast cliffs, their stern faces pallid in the fading light, final and impassable. No sign of gate or entrance, nor a fissure or crack could Frodo see in the frowning wall.
"There are the walls of Moria," said Gandalf, pointing across the water, "and there the gate stood once upon a time, the elven door at the end of the road from Holin, by which we've come. But this way is blocked. None of the company, I guess, will wish to swim this gloomy water at the end of the day. It has an unwholesome look."
"We must find a way round the northern edge," said Gimli. "The first thing for the company to do is to climb up by the main path and see where that will lead us. Even if there were no lake, we could not get our baggage pony up this stair."
"But in any case we cannot take the poor beast into the mines," said Gandalf. "The road under the mountains is a dark road, and there are places narrow and steep which he cannot tread, even if we can."
"Poor old Bill," said Frodo. "I hadn't thought of that. And poor Sam, I wonder what he'll say."
"I'm sorry," said Gandalf. "Poor Bill has been a useful companion, and it goes to my heart to turn him adrift now. I would have travelled lighter and brought no animal, least of all this one that Sam is fond of. If I had had my way, I feared all along that we should be obliged to take this road."
The day was drawing to its end, and cold stars were glinting in the sky high above the sunset, when the company, with all the speed they could, climbed up the slopes and reached the side of the lake. In breadth it looked to be no more than 2 or 3 furlongs at the widest point. How far it stretched away southward they could not see in the failing light, but its northern end was no more than 1/2 mile from where they stood, and between the stony ridges that enclosed the valley and the water's edge there was a rim of open ground. They hurried forward, for they had still 1 or 2 miles to go before they could reach the point on the far shore that Gandalf was making for, and then he had still to find the doors. When they came to the northernmost corner of the lake, they found a narrow creek that barred their way. It was green and stagnant, thrust out like a slimy arm towards the enclosing hills. Gimli strode forward undeterred, and found that the water was shallow, no more than ankle-deep at the edge. Behind him they walked in file, threading their way with care, for under the weedy pools was sliding and greasy stones, and footing was treacherous. Frodo shuddered with disgust at the touch of the dark, unclean water on his feet. As Sam, the last of the company, led Bill up onto the dry ground on the far side, there came a soft sound, a swish, followed by a plop, as if a fish had disturbed the still surface of the water. Turning quickly, they saw ripples, black-edged with shadow in the waning light. Great rings were widening outwards from a point far out in the lake. There was a bubbling noise, and then silence. The dusk deepened, and the last gleams of the sunset were veiled in cloud. Gandalf now pressed on at a great pace, and the others followed as quickly as they could. They reached the strip of land between the lake and the cliffs. It was narrow, often hardly 12 yards across, and unencumbered with fallen rocks and stones, but they found a way, hugging the cliff, and keeping as far from the dark water as they might. 1 mile southwards along the shore they came upon holly trees. Stumps and dead boughs were rotting in the shallows, the remains, it seemed, of old thickets, or of a hedge that had once lined the road across the drowned valley. But close under the cliff there stood, still strong and living, 2 tall trees, larger than any trees of holly that Frodo had ever seen or imagined. Their great roots spread from the wall to the water. Under the looming cliffs they had looked like mere bushes, when seen far off from the top of the stair, but now they towered overhead, stiff, dark, and silent, throwing deep night shadows about their feet, standing like sentinel pillars at the end of the road.
"Well, here we are at last," said Gandalf.
Here the elven way from Holly ended. Holly was the token of the people of that land, and they planted it here to mark the end of their domain, for the west door was made chiefly for their use and their traffic with the lords of Moria. Those were happier days, when there was still close friendship at times between folk of different race, even between dwarves and elves.
"It was not the fault of the dwarves that the friendship waned," said Gimli.
"I have not heard that it was the fault of the elves," said Legolas.
"I have heard both," said Gandalf, "and I will not give judgment now, but I beg you two, Legolas and Gimli, at least to be friends and to help me. I need you both. The doors are shut and hidden, and the sooner we find them, the better. Night is at hand."
Turning to the others, he said,
"While I'm searching, will you each make ready to enter the mines? For here I fear we must say farewell to our good beast of burden. You must lay aside much of the stuff that we brought against bitter weather. You will not need it inside, nor, I hope, when we come through and journey on down into the south. Instead, each of us must take a share of what the pony carried, especially the food and the water skins."
"But you can't leave poor old Bill behind in this forsaken place, Mr. Gandalf," cried Sam, angry and distressed. "I won't have it, and that's flat. After he's come so far and all—"
"I'm sorry, Sam," said the wizard, "but when the door's open, I don't think you'll be able to drag your Bill inside, into the long dark of Moria.
you'll have to choose between Bill and your master.
He'd follow Mr. Frodo into a dragon's den if I led him, protested Sam. It'd be nothing short of murder to turn him loose with all these wolves about.
It will be short of murder, I hope, said Gandalf.
He laid his hand on the pony's head and spoke in a low voice.
Go with words of guard and guiding on you, he said. You are a wise beast, and have learned much in Rivendell. Make your ways to places where you can find grass, and so come in time to Elrond's house, or wherever you wish to go. There, Sam. He'll have quite as much chance of escaping wolves and getting home as we have.
Sam stood sullenly by the pony and returned no answer. Bill, seeming to understand well what was going on, nuzzled up to him, putting his nose to Sam's ear. Sam burst into tears and fumbled with the straps, unlading all the pony's packs and throwing them on the ground. The others sorted out the goods, making a pile of all that could be left behind and dividing up the rest. When this was done, they turned to watch Gandalf. He appeared to have done nothing. He was standing between the two trees, gazing at the blank wall of the cliff, as if he would bore a hole into it with his eyes. Gimli was wandering about, tapping the stone here and there with his axe. Legolas was pressed against the rock, as if listening.
"Well, here we are and all ready," said Merry. "But where are the doors? I can't see any sign of them."
"Dwarf doors are not made to be seen when shut," said Gimli. "They are invisible, and their own masters cannot find them or open them if their secret is forgotten."
"But this door was not made to be a secret known only to dwarves," said Gandalf, coming suddenly to life and turning round.
"Unless things are altogether changed, eyes that know what to look for may discover the signs."
He walked forward to the wall. Right between the shadow of the trees there was a smooth space, and over this he passed his hands to and fro, muttering words under his breath. Then he stepped back.
"Look," he said. "Can you see anything now?"
The moon now shone upon the grey face of the rock, but they could see nothing else for a while. Then slowly on the surface, where the wizard's hands had passed, faint lines appeared, like slender veins of silver running in the stone. At first they were no more than pale gossamer threads, so fine that they only twinkled fitfully where the moon caught them. But steadily they grew broader and clearer, until their design could be guessed. At the top, as high as Gandalf could reach, was an arch of interlacing letters in an elvish character. Below, though the threads were in places blurred or broken, the outline could be seen of an anvil and a hammer surmounted by a crown with seven stars. Beneath these again were two trees, each bearing crescent moons. More clearly than all else, there shone forth in the middle of the door a single star with many rays.
"There are the emblems of Durin," cried Gimli.
"And there is the tree of the High Elves," said Legolas.
"And the star of the House of Feanor," said Gandalf.
"They are wrought of Ithildan that mirrors only starlight and moonlight, and sleeps until it is touched by one who speaks words now long forgotten in Middle-earth. It is long since I heard them, and I thought deeply before I could recall them to my mind."
"What does the writing say?" asked Frodo, who was trying to decipher the inscription on the arch. "I thought I knew the elf letters, but I can't read these."
"The words are in the elven tongue of the west of Middle-earth in the elder days," answered Gandalf. "But they do not say anything of importance to us. They say only, 'The doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, speak, friend, and enter.' And underneath, small and faint, is written, 'I, Narvi, made them.' Celebrimbor of Holin drew these signs."
"What does it mean by 'speak, friend, and enter'?" asked Merry.
"That is plain enough," said Gimli. "If you are a friend, speak the password, and the doors will open, and you can enter."
"Yes," said Gandalf. "These doors are probably governed by words,
Some dwarf gates will open only at special times or for particular persons, and some have locks and keys that are still needed when all necessary times and words are known. These doors have no key. In the days of Durin they were not secret. They usually stood open, and door wards sat here. But if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. At least so it is recorded, is it not, Gimli?
It is, said the dwarf. But what the word was is not remembered. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth.
But do not you know the word, Gandalf?
Asked Boromir in surprise.
No,
said the wizard. The others looked dismayed. Only Aragorn, who knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved.
Then what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot?
Cried Boromir, glancing back with a shudder at the dark water.
You told us that you had passed through the mines. How could that be, if you did not know how to enter?
The answer to your first question, Boromir, said the wizard, is that I do not know the word, yet. But we shall soon see.
And, he added, with a glint in his eyes under their bristling brows,
you may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. As for your other question, do you doubt my tale, or have you no wits left? I did not enter this way. I came from the east. If you wish to know, I will tell you that these doors open outwards. From the inside you may thrust them open with your hands. From the outside nothing will move them save the spell of command. They cannot be forced inwards.
What are you going to do, then? Asked Pippin, undaunted by the wizard's bristling brows.
Knock on the doors with your head, Peregrine Took, said Gandalf. But if that does not shatter them, and I am allowed a little peace from foolish questions, I will seek for the opening words. I once knew every spell in all the tongues of elves or men or orcs that was ever used for such a purpose. I can still remember 80 of them without searching in my mind. But only a few trials, I think, will be needed, and I shall not have to call on Gimli for words of the secret dwarf tongue that they teach to none. The opening words were elvish, like the writing on the arch. That seems certain.
He stepped up to the rock again, and lightly touched with his staff the silver star in the middle beneath the sign of the anvil.
Anonethelen edro hiamen, fen as nogothrem lasto bethlamen,
he said in a commanding voice. The silver lines faded, but the blank grey stone did not stir. Many times he repeated these words in different order, or varied them. Then he tried other spells, one after another, speaking now faster and louder, now soft and slow. Then he spoke many single words of elvish speech. Nothing happened. The cliff towered into the night, the countless stars were kindled, the wind blew cold, and the doors stood fast. Again Gandalf approached the wall, and lifting up his arms he spoke in tones of command and rising wrath.
"Edro! Edro!" he cried, and struck the rock with his staff. "Open! Open!" he shouted, and followed it with the same command in every language that had ever been spoken in the west of Middle-earth. Then he threw his staff on the ground and sat down in silence.
At that moment from far off the wind bore to their listening ears the howling of wolves. Bill the pony started in fear, and Sam sprang to his side and whispered softly to him.
"Do not let him run away," said Boromir. "It seems that we shall need him still, if the wolves do not find us. How I hate this foul pool!"
He stooped, and picking up a large stone, he cast it far into the dark water. The stone vanished with a soft slap, but at the same instant there was a swish and a bubble. Great rippling rings formed on the surface out beyond where the stone had fallen, and they moved slowly towards the foot of the cliff. I wish we could get away, said Merry. "Why doesn't Gandalf do something quick?" said Pippin. Gandalf took no notice of them. He sat with his head bowed, either in despair or in anxious thought. The mournful howling of the wolves was heard again. The ripples on the water grew and came closer. Some were already lapping on the shore. With a suddenness that startled them all, the wizard sprang to his feet. He was laughing.
"I have it!" he cried. "Of course, of course! Absurdly simple, like most riddles when you see the answer."
Picking up his staff, he stood before the rock and said in a clear voice, "Melon!" The star shone out briefly and faded again. Then silently a great doorway was outlined, though not a crack or joint had been visible before. Slowly it divided in the middle and swung outwards inch by inch until both doors lay back against the wall. Through the opening a shadowy stair could be seen climbing steeply up, but beyond the lower steps the darkness was deeper than the night. The company stared in wonder.
"I was wrong after all," said Gandalf, "and Gimli too. Merry, of all people, was on the right track. The opening word was inscribed on the archway all the time. The translation should have been, say, friend, and enter. I had only to speak the elvish word for friend, and the doors opened. Quite simple. Too simple for a learned law master in these suspicious days. Those were happier times. Now let us go."
He strode forward and set his foot on the lowest step. But at that moment several things happened. Frodo felt something seize him by the ankle, and he fell with a cry. Bill the pony gave a wild neigh of fear, and turned tail and dashed away along the lakeside into the darkness. Sam leapt after him, and then, hearing Frodo's cry, he ran back again, weeping and cursing. The others swung around and saw the waters of the lake seething, as if a host of snakes were swimming up from the southern end.
Out from the water a long, sinuous tentacle had crawled. It was pale green and luminous and wet. Its fingered end had hold of Frodo's foot and was dragging him into the water. Sam, on his knees, was now slashing at it with a knife. The arm let go of Frodo, and Sam pulled him away, crying out for help. 20 other arms came rippling out. The dark water boiled, and there was a hideous stench.
"Into the gateway! Up the stairs! Quick!"
shouted Gandalf, leaping back. Rousing them from the horror that seemed to have rooted all but Sam to the ground where they stood, he drove them forward. They were just in time. Sam and Frodo were only a few steps up, and Gandalf had just begun to climb, when the groping tentacles writhed across the narrow shore and fingered the cliff wall and the doors. One came wriggling over the threshold, glistening in the starlight. Gandalf turned and paused. If he was considering what word would close the gate again from within, there was no need. Many coiling arms seized the doors on either side, and with a horrible strength swung them round. With a shattering echo they slammed, and all light was lost. A noise of rending and crashing came dully through the ponderous stone. Sam, clinging to Frodo's arm, collapsed on a step in the black darkness.
"Poor old Bill," he said in a choking voice. "Poor old Bill. Wolves and snakes, but the snakes were too much for him. I had to choose, Mr. Frodo. I had to come with you."
They heard Gandalf go back down the steps and thrust his staff against the doors. There was a quiver in the stone, and the stairs trembled, but the doors did not open.
"Well, well," said the wizard. "The passage is blocked behind us now, and there is only one way out, on the other side of the mountains. I fear from the sounds that boulders have been piled up, and the trees uprooted and thrown across the gate. I'm sorry, for the trees were beautiful, and had stood so long."
"I felt that something horrible was near from the moment that my foot first touched the water," said Frodo. "What was the thing, or were there many of them?"
"I don't know," answered Gandalf, "but the arms were all guided by one purpose. Something has crept,
or has been driven out of dark waters under the mountains. There are older and fouler things than orcs in the deep places of the world. He did not speak aloud his thought that whatever it was that dwelt in the lake, it had seized on Frodo first among all the company. Boromir muttered under